Welcome back to Making It Awkward. I'm your host, Jessica Wilson. Today, I welcome Daphne Jenkins to the podcast to discuss her Hawaiian ancestral foods, how she got into baking butter mochi, and the art of food. She talks about the history, beauty, friction, and tension that she channels into her work today. I also asked her about Hawaiian tourism and about how to visit Hawaii if we were going to do so. Following our talk, she sent me some links that you'll find in the show notes. A quick thanks to the new Patreon members for helping sustain this show, and to Link0333 and Hardly a Fan for their recent reviews and appreciating the awkwardness of this podcast. And with that, I am so excited to introduce my guest,
Daphne Ka'uahi'ilani Jenkins. Hi, everyone.
I'm so excited that you're here. I am so excited to have a very food-focused episode. For folks who cannot see, I recommend going to either YouTube or Spotify and checking out Daphne's background right now because it's amazing. Tell us a bit about yourself.
Hi, everyone. I'm Daphne, and I'm a Portland-based multidisciplinary artist. And it took me so many years to get here to be able to claim the artist identity. I'm an artist, I'm a writer, I'm a home baker. Mm-hmm. And what I do is I explore themes of identity, my identity and belonging as a mixed Kanaka O'iwi wahine born and raised in Hawaii and now living in the diaspora.
Tell us a bit about your ancestral food ways.
I was born and raised on Oahu, and I'm from a mixed multi-ethnic, multicultural family. So my food ways were very diverse, as many are in Hawaii, reflecting the variety of different ethnicities and cultures that intermingle in the lands. So I come from a Chinese and Hawaiian predominant cultural background, but I'm also Black and probably other things too. There's a very strong Chinese influence, as my maternal grandma is Chinese, Hakka Chinese, and did a lot of the feeding me. Mm. And then on the other side of the family, I have a strong matriarch presence from a Chinese Hawaiian grandma as well, Cantonese and Hawaiian. And she is a very influential, like, matriarch gatherer of people. So maybe she wasn't doing the cooking, but she was inviting that side of the family to, like, big potlucks all the time.
Yeah. How do all of those converge with, say, body stuff?
So body stuff. So just like many of the rest of my contemporaries, I grew up in the 80s where there were scales in the kitchen and Weight Watchers before it was WW was being practiced by a lot of the adult females in my family. I was also privy to a lot of media that I didn't see myself, and the folks that I saw were white and thin, and everyone had big hair, but in the 80s.
Yes.
So I marinated in that, and no one had to tell me kind of what was expected or what was the ideal American, if you will, body. Mm-hmm. But I kind of picked it up, and it was like thin, white, mainstream culture. And so that really had an impact on, like, how I wanted to belong or how I wanted to feel like I could fit in. So that affected the way I ate, especially as a teen and a tween during puberty, for sure. So I had some disordered eating patterns, like, as a teen. Also, the school I went to was a really intense school, so I think some of the pressures there drove me to obsess a little bit about, like, body and fitting in that way too.
Mm-hmm. Did that take you either closer or away from your family and ancestral foods, or was it, do you think it was separate?
Ooh, good question. Totally took me away from family. You're like, family and ancestral food. In fact, like, I think if I can think of one food in particular, well, there are a couple, but butter mochi is one. And then Spam is another one where my relationship was, like, on again, off again, if you will, based on what I was internalizing from the community I was in, both at school and then also mainstream media and wellness culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then butter mochi is this, like, such ooey gooey, decadent, buttery, milk, dairy, sugary, treat. It kind of feels like a cheesecake of the Hawaiian cuisine, right? And that was something that was so delicious, but like rich. And so I had like a, I really want it, but I shouldn't, relationship with that as a teen and young adult.
Yeah. Tell me more about your relationship with spam.
I would love to. So, as a kid, I grew up with my parents and grandparents cooking spam almost like bacon. It's very salty. It can crisp up really nice. It goes really well with rice and eggs for breakfast or a spam and cabbage pairing. So, it was a very natural, like weeknight meal, week or weekday breakfast, spam and eggs. And then as a teen, kind of being more like getting ready to go into puberty and body conscious and seeing some mainstream culture and hearing about salads and maybe some Snackwells. You all know, do you all remember
Yes,
Snackwells?
absolutely.
And then there were these Pringles with like Olestra, which like supposedly had no fat, but beware of anal leakage if you eat this chip. So these were my tween and high school years. And so Spam and I were like off as I was trying to navigate like what does it mean to be a healthy teen and not eat like stuff that even some of my cousins who grew up living on the mainland and certainly my aunties from the continent would be like kind of snub spam. So even within my own family were these mixed messages about, depending on who you were with, about what's delicious, what's okay, what's healthy, what's supposed to be eaten.
At what point did you start hearing like the shaming of like Spanish and Portuguese sausage that happens a lot on the mainland? Was it once you moved here or still when you were there?
It was, I think if I'm remembering correctly, it was when family would visit who was living or had been born and raised in the States. So they would visit us and visit grandma and grandpa. Grandma and grandpa were there, grandma and grandpa. And I even remember one of my cousins, I think, was like giggling or at like seeing spam in the pantry. It might have been gleeful. It might have been a gleeful giggle because I'm not sure if she got to have that in her home. It might have been an identifier, but it also might have been like, oh my gosh, it's this forbidden thing. I'm not sure, but it was a confusing, yeah, it was a confusing thing to witness because for me, I was like, yeah, breakfast.
And you mentioned butter mochi, and this seems to have come full circle for you.
I feel like it has. Butter mochi was a dish or a tray bake I was exposed to, I think, while I was doing middle school volleyball tournaments, like these all-day shebangs where it was just like constant games, and then you'd have to referee a game, so it really wasn't rest. And I feel like somebody, a teammate's mom, made like a tray of butter mochi, and it would be like it's like the power bar, really, for the athlete because it is so rich and it's got like a lot of those. It's got carbs, it's got fat, it's got sugar. It's like what post workout, like it's perfect. And it's delicious. So we would nosh on that in between games. It's also pretty easy to like polish off a few pieces instead of have to poke around like a plate. And so I was exposed there, but then really thought of it as this decadent thing. I mean, we were like powering through so many games all day. So like that was the context I was having it. Not like a direct earn your food vibe, but like a implied. Like this is okay now because you're like exhausting yourself physically. Yeah. So when the pandemic hit, I pivoted. I pivoted from a holistic nutrition and food relationship practice to like straight up comfort and a food I had reserved for like special occasions. I was like, we're doing sourdough. And I was like, okay, what is my version of like bubbling sourdough starter? Like, that's just not me. Like, ha, butter mochi. And I happen to have like the shelf stable pantry items like coconut milk and Mochiko, Koda Farms always in my pantry. So I just had to grab eggs and butter and like I could whip up a batch pretty easy.
So tell us like everything that goes into it. So how would so people are likely familiar with mochi, but like what makes butter mochi mochi?
Okay, so the sweet rice flour or the mochiko flour is the thing that gives mochi its ooey gooey, like chew texture is what they call it. So it's got that chew, it's a little bit gummy. I think it's amylopectin, if I remember right from nutrition school. You're like, whatever. And then there's coconut milk is a really important ingredient. And I think I love that for Hawaii, just that coconut's like a native tree, Niu. Then we have butter. Thanks, America. Thanks, cows. Butter and sugar, another crop also that was part of the plantation economy in Hawaii. So I kind of love like reclaiming that, being like, yeah, that's sugar. And yeah, we made it, a lot of sugar. That CNH sugar you're all buying stands for California and Hawaiian. So, but that's why it has the hibiscus flower on it, Also, sugar, I guess it played a major role in the overthrow of, the Hawaiian kingdom. So sugar plantation owners were like, hey, we see how we can make tons of money. Let's annex, ourselves to Hawaii and make it rich. So butter mochi has those things. And then I like to put in my own spin using either fruit that's grown in Hawaii and pairing it with like something seasonal and local-ish on the West Coast here, or just like going bonkers off into creative flavor land, like something savory, like black sesame with some tamari, or something Halloweeny, like squash, or pumpkin spice latte, something like that. So I have fun. It became a medium for me, like a canvas to play with.
Nice. I was so excited after meeting you for brunch. You gave me a little to-go pack for the plane. It was your pineapple. Is it just upside? Tell me what it was so I don't.
Well, I started off with calling it, it was pineapple, it's upside down cake inspired. But I have rebranded it recently just for kicks to pineapple overthrow to like highlight the overthrow of the kingdom. I'm like, I kind of do throw it over when I cut it. So I had that, I gave you pineapple upside down or pineapple overthrow butter mochi. And then I think I gave you a savory one.
You did.
Black sesame with maybe kabocha squash.
Yes. And the little, was it tamari on the side
Little
or?
sauce for some tamari, salty sauce.
Oh yeah, I actually took it all the way home with me because you gave it to me for the plane, and I was like, no, this is too special to be eating on a little tiny pullout tray. I'm gonna take this home. I'm still thinking about this food, like as I am, in the car back. I come back, I sit it down, and I'm like, okay, now I can experience this moment. I had never had butter mochi, and I'm glad I waited because that, the plane would not have been, the place to have this experience. It was amazing.
It was your first time? I had no idea.
Yes, it was great.
Oh my
I've
gosh.
only seen your artistic like renditions of butter mochi, which is amazing. Folks, if you have not been to Daphne's Instagram, I'll link it. Definitely go. But yeah, I've always wondered what it tasted like.
I'm so delighted to have served you like both a sweet and a savory and like a little bento pack. I'm
It's amazing. Oh.
so glad you liked it.
Me? Yeah, I did not share it at all.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
So I mentioned already the designs that you have put on your mochi. Can you connect your artist identity to food art and mochi?
Yes. I think food, art, and butter mochi in particular helped me own that I was an artist. I think I've always been an artist, but it hasn't really been easy for me, both in how I was raised. Not necessarily my parents, also the schooling, very much like meritocratic, very much like you need to optimize your earning potential kind of vibes. And I'm sure my family would have been like very supportive of that too, of ha me having a good life or being able to get a good life by achieving things. So I was thinking when I was growing up, I was thinking of like being a doctor or like a lawyer or something like that, and not an artist because I didn't know how the artists would make the money. It wasn't readily apparent. I didn't know many. So once I started feeding myself and then delighting in making it pretty and making it taste good, and then really feeling like I could express my identity, away from home, but still eat like home where I'm living now, home, then I realized like it wasn't a way for me to express myself. And I was like, that is what an artist does.
Yeah. And where has being an artist and Butter Mochi taken you these days?
Oh, I was so, so honored this year. I just finished my first ever artist residency. It feels so even like weird to say that because I was then said I was an artist. I'm an artist and I applied for an artist residency and got it. Mm-hmm. So I must be an artist.
Yes.
But I just finished that in March and I went with a cohort of 8 other amazing artists. And it was like I glimpsed the future of what could be, you know, with community mm-hmm. care, with like BIPOC to the front, queer people centered, like mm-hmm. how's everyone doing check-ins? Do we want to hang out? Do we not want to? Just the level of care that was there based on all of us brought it there. Mm-hmm. And we're ready. It was like a meant to be meeting of minds and hearts. So that was tremendous. And also I got to work on a cookbook proposal while there. That was the art that I was like, does this count as art? If I'm writing a cookbook proposal to try mm-hmm. to get a cookbook that I don't even know if I'm going to get. And luckily I got it. So I was able to do some recipe development and work a little bit more on that business plan for the cookbook, which is a proposal. That part.
Yeah. That's so great to have time to do that, like concentrated time when you know this is what you're doing. That's great. So, and then cookbook, but also community. Butter Mochi brought you community.
It really did. I mean, what a weird time. You know, 2020, it felt so isolating in many ways. So I think what artists do is they get impacted by that and they're like, ah. So I was like, oh, Butter Mochi, I must express myself. And then I started doing Instagram drops every Friday to mark the time. Cause like, what day was it?
Yeah, I know.
So I was like, I'll do Aloha Friday, Butter Mochi drops. And I first started doing it for family and friends, like a small following of people. Mm-hmm. And then it grew. And more people were DMing me within the first 5 minutes of me posting and like selling me out. And so I made more and more. But through this experiment, I called it an experiment at the time, I met some of the greatest friends that I've ever had in Portland. I've met mm-hmm. artists, more people like me, and they love the mochi, or they got it because they grew up in Hawaii and then shared with their friends. So I found like-minded and hearted people by being like who I am and making Butter Mochi.
And ending up in the Washington Post.
Yes. And connecting with other people who love and adore food and say my name in rooms when they have the option to be in the Washington Post. Thank you, Taffy Elrod. Love you. Taffy has a Juneteenth picture book for children that just came out. So check out that book.
Plug.
Yep.
Cookie recipe was it? I was looking through all of them. Which cookie on there was yours?
I submitted a recipe for a tung mai cookie, and tung mai is something unique to Hawaii. The actual rice cake is not unique. It's got I think it's called mi tung if you say it correctly in Chinese, but things get swirled around and pigeoned and changed in Hawaii. So we refer to it as tung mai, probably incorrectly, but we know it as that. And it's like this crumbly, almost like a Rice Krispie treat, but with none of the chew, just like bound together by a sugary substance. So it's really crackly mm-hmm. and kind of a hard eating experience. And my relatives, my Chinese relatives, would always bring us tung mai for the holidays. So around New Year, December, January, and it would come in this like plastic bin. And I mean, it was like, it's when we'd see them. We'd see our Chinese relatives around the New Year doing, mm-hmm. you know, offering a Chinese tung mai. And they were crumbly and it was just tradition. So what I did is I took that tung mai and crumbled it up into a brown cookie and kind of made it my own. And I guess between the lines, reading between the lines, you know, like I said before, within my own family, there were different kind of pressures and ideas mm-hmm. of how one should be and how one should belong. And I felt that too from the Chinese side of my family. Like they were always mentioning like how big I was, how brown I was, and oh, did I really go to that school? Some might call it microaggressions, some might call it love.
Curious out, yes.
It depends on your culture. But it was pretty normal to experience that. And so putting it to my Christmas cookie in the Washington Post was like my way of reclaiming something that was really Chinese and like making it Chinese Hawaiian, Black, Daphne-ish. Putting in a cookie, making it kind of like an easier eating experience.
Nice. I love it. That whole tower was beautiful in the
Right?
yeah, it's amazing.
Those stylists, they know what they're doing.
Very true. Very true. And speaking of the things I see on Instagram, I saw a pineapple upside down mochi croissant sandwich situation. And I needed to hear more. I was so impressed.
Well, I saw, I think it was on TikTok. I see these viral food things too, and I find them interesting too. And I think I saw, I mean, everyone must see, people are putting cookie dough in croissants. I'm not sure who started it. I'm not sure if it started in France. I don't know where it started, but my first thought was like, why? I mean, it's fun to play, like, of course, like in, if you're playing, play. But I was thinking in terms of like the eating experience, I was like, croissants are kind of flaky and cookies are, can be soft, and it's like I didn't really see like a very different texture, or I was seeing like the croissant being treated more like a cookie, and then I'm like, you're ruining all the flakiness of the croissant with like a cookie. Well, you know, like all of that lamination is like getting cookie doughed. So thinking of that, I was like, well, for me, if I'm putting it together, it would be fun to pair something light, flaky, crunchy, fluffy with like something chewy, ooey, gooey, dense, and then get that textural contrast. Mochi, butter mochi. So at first I started playing with, I think, kulolo, which is really the thing I would love to have made every week instead of butter mochi if I had access to poi or paiai or taro and coconut. If I was in Hawaii, maybe I would have been the kulolo queen instead of butter mochi. But here in the diaspora, it's easier for me to get butter mochi ingredients. But anyway, they've got the same kind of viscous texture. So putting kulolo into croissants was like my first thing I played with at the artist residency.
Oh.
And then I made like a batch of what's called chichidango. So like it was hot pink strawberry flavored and like a little bit of milk, but mochi texture. And that went into the croissant. And then the next level was the pineapple overthrow butter mochi. Had to meet the toasted crispy croissant. And let me tell you, those textures, that those combinations, all of them were like chef's kiss.
I love this. I would love to ask you about tourism in Hawaii since I have you here.
Yes, it's important.
Yes, I'm glad that people have been talking about it for the last, I don't know, few 4 years. I've seen a lot more of it online. I also know that there's a new Hawaiian tourism authority there. So there seems like a lot of things that are going on, and people are obviously not going to stop traveling to Hawaii. So I'm wondering if you have thoughts overall on, yes, Hawaiian tourism.
Absolutely. I have all the thoughts and all the feelings, and it's a mixed bag. It's a mixed bag. Where we are right now, or where my family's back on Oahu, I don't live. I'm not a Hawaii resident. I'm not a kama'aina right now. I'm away from home. But we've gotten to a point where a lot of our land use is being appropriated for serving others rather than the local people. That's just where we are. I think if it's something like either between 85 to 95% of our food is imported in a tanker to Hawaii. Our land is fertile AF, but the way it's being used is not for feeding all of the population of Hawaii. It's being used to host, or and or it was a plantation, you know, so used for monocropping or development for homes. And during the pandemic, home prices soared because folks were realizing they could work remotely from anywhere. So why not, you know, their version of paradise? So there were a lot of folks who didn't originate in Hawaii and had no ties that moved to their idea of paradise. So tourism is a fraught topic because Hawaii is at the same time as people might resist and be like, oh, tourism, it's terrible. And I wish it was just local people that lived here. There's a reliance upon the industries of and hospitality that's developed over the years. And so I don't know what the answer is, because going to Hawaii and spending money in Hawaii and supporting local or mom and pop is probably is going to help local mom and pop spots and help the people and the families affiliated with them stay. At the same time, if the same folks supporting those businesses are also touching wildlife and riding on seals and and using our resources because they're going hiking on places they shouldn't be, so requiring rescue and stuff that would otherwise be used for local support is being directed to people who aren't following just general common sense, then that detracts again from like the help, right? So there's ways of visiting and you will fall in love with the land. I mean, the land is beguiling and like embraces us all and is like, I'm beautiful. Come be with me. Like, you're not crazy to feel that. The land definitely is saying that. And I think there's a way to travel with intention, respect, and a plan of how you're going to give back to the land and the people of the land. And I just invite folks to sit with that and like do the research and do the educating. Awkwardly ask your friends and they'll be like, no, I don't want to give you my labor, but free, but you can bring me back some delicious foods in exchange or offer. And then, you know what? There are more Hawaiians, more Kanaka o'iwi living away from Hawaii than they are living in Hawaii. So you might be able to support Hawaii, because we Hawaiians say, hey, Hawaii au. We don't say, I am Hawaiian. We say, I am Hawaii. You might be able to support Hawaii in your own community by patronizing businesses owned by folks from Hawaii who have had to move into the diaspora, many not by choice,
right?
To have a more affordable cost of living and a place to take care of their families. So you don't have to go to the islands to support Hawaii. We out here. We sling in the butter mochi. We're making the plate lunches. True. Making doing the tattoos.
Oh gosh, what do you think about tribal tattoos? Sorry, this is not a plan, but you just mentioned that and I'm like, oh.
I have one. I have a tattoo that uses a lot of Native Hawaiian iconography. And I think again, it's a personal choice and art is art, but you know, have some common sense. Know what it's mean, know what it means. Go to the right people. Don't act stupid, as we would say.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Don't be an asshole.
Don't be an asshole. No. Don't appropriate things that aren't yours.
Yes.
If you're invited to, it's a different thing. Mm. But if you're like, I'm going to get myself. There's nuance. There's incredible nuance in it all.
Totally. I can see people listening and wondering what a plan to give back, as you mentioned, would even like where someone would start with that type of research. Do you have either thoughts or suggestions for people?
My suggestion would be to really take time to do the research. If you want, are they like a community member? Do a few more clicks, dive deeper into it and suss that out. I know that although there are a lot of the folks on the Hawaii Tourism Board, I'm not saying any names because I might need to move back one day and they might need to be a job. Straight up. But they have interests, right? So they might be affiliated with an airline. They might be affiliated with hospitality, with hotels. And so, but I do know one thing they're trying to do. And again, nothing is perfectly 100% great. Is they're trying to shine a light more on Hawaiian culture, on Hawaiian owned businesses. They're really trying to highlight that. So things are moving in a direction that will point to more mom and pop places that will guide and educate. And then there are also like some Office of Hawaiian Affairs is a website that I go to and look for Hawaiian news for Native Hawaiian people. And there may be businesses there or articles there that share about businesses owned by Hawaiian people. In Hawaii, it's really important to know, like when we say we're Hawaiian. We're not like saying we're Californian or Oregonian, but there's like an indigeneity, an Aboriginal implication for Kanaka O'iwi, people of the bone, Kanaka Maoli, or Native Hawaiian folks.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that.
You're welcome. Thanks for asking.
You and I have bonded a bit about living in Portland as women of color. a constant journey.
Yes.
Yes. What do you think about the Pacific Northwest in general?
Well, here's where it's my turn to say, like, the land is like, hey, girl, I got mountains, I got coasts. That's familiar to you, isn't it? I'm like, yes. You know, and here I am in the Ring of Fire in the Pacific Rim. So I'm drawn to the land, to the water.
Mm-hmm.
In Hawaiian, the word for water is vai, W-A-I, and for the word for wealth is vai-vai. It's like double water. Mm-hmm. Like, then you're rich. And I certainly feel that the Pacific Northwest has tons of water.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful, lush greenery. A lot of things grow here. So I'm able to, like, have the privilege to get a CSA and partake in community supported agriculture and eat the fresh, delicious, ripe stuff. But yeah, living here as a human body that's brown in this particular city has been difficult. And the sense of belonging, my sense of belonging here has definitely been stressed. In some ways, that informs my art practice because it gives me something to press against. It gives me some friction and tension. But it's an everyday navigation to be different, brown, other here. Although so many more Hawaiians are moving here, as I said, to be able to afford a place to live and thrive.
To Portland specifically?
West Coast in general, but I think I saw statistics and they were like, the population growth has been Hawaiians. Like, or, I don't know. I'm pretty sure we've had quite a few folks come over to this area, and it shows in all the, like, mom and pop businesses and in the people who are frequenting them.
Wow.
I see. Yeah, we lose our tan over here, but but we can still connect. We can still connect with people.
Yes. How can people find you? What are all the ways?
I am on Instagram. Please follow my personal page because I'm trying to build a following to show publishers that people might want to buy my book if I write it. So that is at Daphne, D-A-P-H-N-E underscore K, K for Ka'ua He'ilani, underscore Jenkins, Daphne K. Jenkins on Insta. And then I also have my butter mochi on at Ono Mao Goods on Instagram if you want to check out some of the batches I made.
Yeah. And how can people in Portland buy your mochi?
You can find me on Insta, and I have links in my profile to my website. A DM, an email works great. And then you can stay tuned to socials because I'll post my next events where I'll pop up or be selling.
And yes, even if you're not interested or able to buy, highly recommend following just for the art. I'll say again, it's beautiful. It just lights up my Instagram feed. I will definitely say that.
Yes, follow to see what I put in a croissant next, right? Like, enough with these white chefs taking our food. I'm going to take their food. I'm going to put my food up in it.
So true. I love that. All right. Thank you so much for coming on today and chatting and sharing with all of us.
Thank you for having me, Jessica. I hope to have a book under my belt in the future, just like you. I want to be like you.
Oh, goodness. Thank you so much. I can't wait to read and to come back up there and eat more of your butter mochi.
Let's do it.
Thanks so much to Daphne for chatting with me. You can find her links to her Instagram and some resources she mentioned in the show notes. I'll also link to information about the overthrow of Hawaii in 1893 and U.S. annexation of Hawaii in 1898. Next week, I hope to bring you my interview with Sasha Chavkin, the reporter from the Examination News who recently released an article with the Washington Post about the co-optation of anti-diet dietitians by big food companies. As you can imagine, I have many follow-up questions and am already thinking this will be a two-part episode. Until next time, make it awkward, friends. The best way to support the show is by rating, reviewing, and sharing it with a friend. You can become a sustaining Patreon member of the show, which will support the edits and episode mixing of Jen Jacobs at the link in bio. This has been an episode of Making It Awkward. I'm Jessica Wilson. This podcast is supported in part by the legacy of Sacramento Outboard Services.